This is the Beautiful Writers Podcast. I'm Linda Sievertson, and today is super special for me because our guest is Danielle Laporte, the incredible writer and visionary who was my partner in crime in the formation and hosting of this podcast in its first year. One of our initial interviewees was Danny Shapiro, who happens to be our guest host today. So this is just yummy old home week stuff for me. At any rate, I think it kind of goes without saying, but just in case, here are some quickie bio details on these two. Danielle Laporte is an invited member of Oprah's inaugural Super Soul 100. She's also author of The Firestarter Sessions, A Guide to Creating Success on Your Own Terms, and The Desire Map, A Guide to Creating Goals with Soul, and its yearly day planner, journal system, iTunes app, and workshop program. This new book, White Hot Truth, Clarity for Keeping It Real on Your Spiritual Path from One Seeker to Another, launched on May 15th. Millions of visitors go to DanielleLaporte.com every month for her daily truth bombs and more, so check her out there. Danny Shapiro is the bestselling author of the memoir Still Writing, Devotion in Slow Motion, and 5 novels. Danny was a guest on Oprah's Super Soul Sunday, and she teaches writing in multiple venues, which you can learn about over at DannyShapiro.com. I should say that Danielle, Danny, and I pre-taped this conversation a couple of weeks ago because the two of them are currently on tour, Danielle for White Hot Truth and Danny for her new memoir, Hourglass, Time, Memory, Marriage. But despite the timing, I think you're going to hear them talking about things you haven't heard them cover before. What I love about this conversation is that there's a level of vulnerability and girlfriend talk that I was not expecting. I'll give you a quick hint. If you ever compare yourself to beautiful, accomplished women like Danielle and Danny and think they've got it all so easy when it comes to hair and makeup and clothes and getting up in front of people, you may just want to kiss the ground with what they have to share. Another thing. You're going to hear us talking about Danielle's upcoming book launch party in New York, which has actually just taken place. It was amazing, not unlike a rock concert. Okay, I love these ladies so much. They're two of the most profound, beautiful writers alive. I know I compliment all of my interviewees, and I always mean it. One thing you know if you listen to this show often is that when I'm a fan, I'm a fan. I cannot contain my enthusiasm. And why would you want me to? You don't want me to do that. So here we go. Let's fan out together, shall we? Welcome. Danny, you're back again. I don't even know how I got so lucky. Thank you so much for rallying while you're in the middle of your book tour.
It's totally my pleasure. It's great to be here with you.
Okay, so you've got to give us a bit of scoop on the tour before we bring on Danielle. So tell me if I've got this right. In a few short weeks, Hourglass has been on the cover of Kirkus. It's been starred by Publishers Weekly. Beautiful coverage by NPR. You were Snapchat quote of the day. You had a drawing of your face immortalized in the Wall Street Journal. On and on. Chosen as an indie next great read. People magazine pick for great Mother's Day gifts. Oh my gosh. Are you exhausted?
You know, all the stuff that you're saying is like the wind beneath my wings. You know, I'm out there going to 26 cities to promote Hourglass. And whenever anything like that happens, I just feel like, yay, it's very energizing. And it's also incredibly energizing to meet readers and do these events where I'm starting to see the way the book means a lot to people. So no, I'm not exhausted. I mean, well, Danielle could probably also really speak to this, but it's a shift in a way of thinking. I could be exhausted. I could talk about how busy I am. But instead, I've really been just doing that tiny little inward shift of seeing it differently. It's amazing how small a shift it is and how profound the difference is. And really just saying, no, this is incredibly exciting and thrilling and what an opportunity. And my publisher is sending me to all these places and I get to meet my people.
Oh, I love the shift and the slightness of it. I totally hear you. And it's so simple to change our perspective and to stop using words like overwhelm and exhaustion and to focus on the things that make us feel good. I am so looking forward to having Danielle on today. The two of us loved interviewing you in 2015, and so much has happened since then for both of you. As the author of Devotion, I know you resonate so strongly with Danielle's new book, which
is so much about soul and service and devotion and being your own guru. And the two of you are really kindred seekers. You're not pushovers. You ask questions until you're blue and you don't accept pat or stale answers for anything, much less spirituality. So I think this is going to be a great conversation.
Oh, yeah. I think one of the things that I resonate so much with in terms of Danielle's work is her radical sort of take no prisoners honesty. You know, it's funny because when I think back in terms of my own work, I don't write self-help, but I do, as it turns out, write books that have helped people in various ways. And when I think about what Danielle's doing with White Hawk Truth and everything that she's been doing in the last couple of years, it seems so much about really telling the truth to people about the way it is, not, you know, not offering placebos, just the kind of platitudes that it's sort of the opposite. A truth bomb is like the opposite of a platitude.
That's so true.
I was thumbing through Danielle's book earlier today, and there's this moment sort of midway through where in her inimitable, beautiful script, there's just this line, "You're the answer to your question." Mm. And, you know, it just reminded me of so much that I've been thinking about lately about self-knowledge and the incredible power of it. So I'm hoping we can talk about that too. Like self-knowledge, like self-knowledge is a superpower. And we develop it over the course of many, many years. I feel like I am only now in my early 50s actually fully kind of inhabiting that as an idea. Like if I have to be this old, I said that, I was like, oh my God, I really am that old. If I have to be that old, then at least what's happening and what's going along with that is this incredible feeling of knowing myself and where that can take me in the world.
Mm, and I so agree. And then the flip side of that is the older I get, the less I believe I do know. Isn't that interesting, that dichotomy?
Well, there's the knowing less about what's going to happen or what's going to transpire. But knowing yourself, I think, is something different than that.
Totally. You know, I flipped when Dee sent me the book, as I do when she sends me any new book. I've always said she's one of the most beautiful writers, I believe, alive in this generation or past. But especially what got me excited were the revelations that she started feeling hornier than usual at her brief stint at an ashram and craving illicit things like a pack of smokes and loud Led Zeppelin. That's so our rebel Dee. She reminds me a bit of you, actually, about how in devotion you admitted that you'd never been much of a joiner. I never have been either, but here we are, all joining together to shine a little light where we can, right?
Right, absolutely. But part of, I think, what allows us to do that, what allows anyone to do that, is that kind of honesty. When I teach at places like Kripalu, and I look around the room and I ask for a show of hands, how many people here are in this room for the first time or at a retreat for the first time, and with my people who come to my things, it's often a lot of people. And I tell the story about the first time I came there and the way that I called my husband to say, I think I might be in the wrong place. Maybe I really need to just come home. I don't belong here. You know, I'm out of place and everybody's wearing Birkenstocks. And my husband, who had been a war correspondent who was based in Africa, he's like, yeah, sweetie, I understand. When I used to land in Somalia, I used to feel the same way. I was like, okay, I think I can handle this retreat in the Berkshire Mountains.
When the bombs were going off, I used to feel a little uncomfortable, a little out of my element.
Yeah, I wanted to come home too, yeah. But being able to say that, I look at the relief in people's faces around the room when I say, first of all, when I say me too, but also really saying, give yourself permission to feel whatever you feel without judging it. There's not one spiritually enlightened mountaintop place to be. And anyone who thinks that they've arrived there is the opposite of enlightened.
All right, let's bring her on. Danielle, welcome, welcome, love.
I just want to keep listening to you guys dropping truth bombs about my truth bombs. This is so good.
Danielle, for old time's sake, I just have to ask you, can you open us up with your everything you need prayer?
Oh, okay. Wherever you are, whatever you're doing, it's a good time to take a breath. We know that we have everything that we need, that everything is progress, and that brilliance, as in light, is shining on us now. Mm.
Okay, so I always call you Dee, but if I say, hey, Dee, it might be a little confusing since both of your names start with Dee. So I'm going to try really hard to use full names from now on. To both of you, your new books are stunningly beautiful. And I want to ask you each the same question. Let's start with Danielle, but with one of our old favorite questions, Danielle, that we used to ask, what did you do with this book prayerfully, if anything, to coax the muse?
I put all of my stories in a bucket, and you remember you did one workshop, and then you remember, oh God, I did that workshop, and oh, there was that workshop where I peeled out of the space in the middle of the night in my rental car. Oh. And then I just asked, may I be of service? I hope these are useful. Yeah, that was the prayer. Make me useful. That's always the prayer.
Beautiful. Danny, what about you on Hourglass? Anything specific that you did differently or the same as usual?
Yeah, I actually resonate with Danielle's bucket a little bit. You know, one of my favorite quotes about writing comes from the choreographer, Martha Graham. And I won't quote the whole thing, but she was writing a letter to her friend, Agnes DeMille, who was also a choreographer and who was feeling really disheartened at that moment. And Martha Graham wrote to her and said, keep the channel open. No artist is pleased. And it goes on, but I was thinking a lot, and I always thought a lot about what it means to keep the channel open. And in this case, because I was writing about marriage, my marriage, and I was writing about it from inside of it, from like the white hot center of it, and really wanting to explore that. But in a way, it wasn't a story that I was telling. It was an exploration of time and memory and marriage and what it is to meet our younger selves through time. And so one day I woke up and I thought, you know what? I need index cards and I need them now. And I drove all the way to Staples, which is, I live in the country in New England, and it's about a half an hour from my house. And I thought, as I'm driving to Staples, I'm thinking, have I lost my mind? Like, why do I need to essentially take like 90 minutes in the middle of my day to buy index cards? And I brought them home, and they turned into the centerpiece of my process, maybe a little bit like Danielle's bucket, where every time I had a thought about something that I thought would belong in Hourglass, I scribbled it on an index card. And I just kept this big fat stack of cards with me as I was working. And when I was stuck or I didn't know where I was going next, I would shuffle through them. I would look through them almost as if it was the I Ching. And just see if what the next passage that belonged, because the structure of the book is mosaic-like, so there's a space between each passage. It wasn't like there was momentum carrying me along. I had to pause, I had to be mindful, and I really had to stop and think about what the white space was even doing between these two ideas and where the next passage was taking me.
Danielle, I'd like to hear about your process, because I seem to remember you telling me something about laying things all over the ground. It sounded similar to the cards.
I look for the creative spine. It's what Twilight Dark calls the creative spine. So I get everything out, and then I think, I know there's a sequence in here somewhere. And it happens like on my dining room or living room floor, and post-it notes, and I say, first I need to talk about trying so hard, and then comes exhaustion, and then, you know, a few more steps, and then after betrayal, let's insert something here, and then there's forgiveness, and then I got to wrap all this up with devotion. So yeah, that's how I do it. And then a lot of the chapters got flushed out on their own, not knowing where they were going to fit in the rhythm of things. I just needed to like say everything I needed to say on that one particular topic. And sometimes I would go backwards. So it was like, there's that story I have, that workshop, the divorce, the ashram. And I'd figure out what the lesson was in it, but it just felt like a really hot, juicy story. And then sometimes it was the reverse. Like, we've got to talk about forgiveness on the spiritual path. And I've got a really strong opinion about what I would consider a more holistic and practically divine approach to forgiveness. So I need a story to support that. So back and forth.
Yeah, I mean, there's a way in which it's music, don't you think, Danielle? You described the spine, you know, Twilight Tharp's spine. I always think of it as having a shape, that emerges through the work. You can't impose it on what doesn't exist yet, right? It has to unfold, and then you begin to see what belongs to what and what the spine is or what the shape is.
Yeah, and you can't take it too seriously. I mean, at some point, you just have to say, oh, this is going to work. I'm going to get my point across. It doesn't really matter. For me, the order doesn't really matter, but yeah, you just have to trust. This is good. This is useful.
So, Danielle, what was it like for you to work on this book? I know you always travel a tremendous amount and you're speaking and leading all over the world. Did you carve time out for yourself to work on this book, or did you work on it as you were doing everything else that you do in the world?
No, I was ruthlessly inaccessible for this. And I sat, you know, got together with the team and said, if you're up for it, your job is to protect me for the next 6 to 9 months. I trust you, take care of things. Like, I'm still in. It was the first time I considered, well, I was actually told, I didn't consider it. I was told I was no longer required in team meetings. And this was revolutionary. So I'm hanging out with one of my best friends / advisors. And she's like, Dee, they don't need you to be on those calls, because if you keep going on those calls, you're never going to get this book finished. I was like, yeah, but it's only like 1 hour, 2 hours a week. She's like, it's a whole day. Because this is my theory, right? One phone call can ruin your whole day. I need space. Yesterday, Mondays are my for sure free flow writing days. And I just look at my day plan. I'm like, oh, nothing. I don't even have to put on my mascara. And I know if there's no mascara involved in that day, I'm going to write the best stuff I've written all week. There's correlation between mascara and brilliant writing.
Oh, that's a great criteria.
And I cannot write on the road. Every once in a while, I can do what I think is a decent blog post on the airplane, but I can't finish chapters or think about structure while I'm in hotel rooms. It just doesn't happen. I maybe do some notes on my Moleskin, but I need home time. I need to not be traveling that much. And for the last 3 months, nothing, zero, nothing. I miss birthdays, you know, apologize to friends. I'm not coming up for air. There was just like a lot of yoga pant wearing and not a lot of yoga classes.
Yeah. I'm relieved to hear you say that, because my process, including the yoga pants, including the mascara, the deep, deep dive, I carved out about 9 months of absolutely no teaching. The groundwork for it began with saying no to things, learning how to say, no, I'm afraid that won't be possible. I'm not going to be able to do that. Knowing that I would have this chunk of time in order to be able to work exclusively on the book, because anything else, an email, a phone call, a meal, an encounter, can really throw off the entire creative process. It's really true.
Well, it's the favorite part of my life, really. I mean, other than the being with my kid and my friends, I find there's this cycle for me where about every 4 to 6 months, I have this really angsty moment of like, oh my God, I need more help. I need to get someone to come and rake the leaves. And if someone could just cut and peel carrots for me and put them in the fridge, I could get so much more writing done. And then I think about, okay, just stop. What do I really want to have happen? What is it that I really want to be doing? And I think back to the time when I had 4 months where nobody expected anything from me because I was finishing a book. And I'm like, oh my God, I want to live my whole life that way. So like where I'm headed is I just am going to become this eccentric, inaccessible human. I'm going to live in a barn with like a dial-up. Because it's heaven. It's total heaven for me. And I got to come out. I'm just as thrilled now to get on airplanes and talk and wear mascara and eyeliner and do my thing. And then it'll be time to be eccentric again.
That's so incredibly interesting to me. And it was one of the things that I wanted to ask you about and talk to you about, because I think that balance is an illusion and something that we, especially women, kind of almost castigate ourselves with, this idea that we can find a way to put our lives in balance and do everything all at once equally well, when in fact it seems to me the way that you're describing wanting to be the hermetic lady with the dial-up, that's a part of you, right? Like it may be the truest part. It certainly is where the work comes from. But would you want to be that hermetic lady all the time? Or would it even be possible? I guess this is something that I've been thinking about a lot. In the world that we live in, with all of the social media and the level of busyness and noise, it's a very different world. I mean, look, Hourglass is my 9th book. This publication, for me, more than ever, I've noticed how amped up having to be and also wanting to be very engaged online and very much out there in the world, traveling, appearing. You know, the biggest challenge for me, I'm packing to go on a whole bunch more tour stops tomorrow morning. I can't figure out hair and I can't figure out shoes. I'm trying to just book hair appointments in cities coming up so that I can get up in front of a crowd and not feel like a miserable wretch. And things that guy writers don't, in fact, have to contend with.
Right.
We could do a whole panel discussion just on that. People don't, these are great problems to have. I don't think people don't realize the stress. Like, I've had to say to my team, like, you guys, no, listen. What am I going to do about my hair? Like, I know we got the gig. You can get a great gig, and the first thing you think of is, okay, I'm 3 hours behind, so when I get up at 6 a.m. there, it's really 3 a.m. my time. So I'm going to need something for the bags under my eyes. I need someone to put on my false eyelashes because you can't go under big lights with it. And how do I get my hair done? And then I actually do want to be grounded and center and have like 20 minutes to meditate. Someone apparently, there's a great online outlet, is going to follow me for the day of my book launch. And my publicist was saying, so they want to come to your hotel in the morning and film you with your morning routine. I was like, no fucking way ever. Are you kidding? And, you know, I talked to my other speaker friends and everybody's like, oh yeah, you're happy to get the gig. And the first thing is like, what am I going to wear? Mm-hmm. And I hope this just doesn't sound like awful and prima donna-ish, but there's just really basic female, am I pretty enough and rested enough to be on stage and to look together to do this? And how do you pull it off? And I was watching a documentary. I'm really into Pink Floyd right now. I was watching Roger Waters' documentary about his last tour he did for The Wall. And dude is just wearing a black t-shirt, black pair of jeans, white sneakers, gets out of his car and gets on stage. And I was like, you know, she does not have the same problems that Lady Gaga or Katy Perry or any of the big.
It's why Steve Jobs didn't even shave.
Yeah, it's why Steve Jobs wore the black long sleeve t-shirt and jeans every damn day. I mean, it's so much easier. In fact, I have a friend, a really dear friend of mine, has been in the public eye on a pretty large scale for about 25 years. And she wears a wig. And she has hair. She has beautiful hair. But she wears a wig. I don't even know how she gets it to look so good with real hair underneath it. I feel like if you wear a wig, you have to shave your head. But she doesn't. But she's like, Linda, it doesn't matter where I go. My hair always looks good. It doesn't frizz. My hair's frizzball. So if I go to Florida and do an event, I'm just totally stressed about it. I don't know. You have to straighten it. And then the straightener wears off after a couple of months. So then I'm like, oh, I got to schedule a straightening. It's a pain in the ass. I'm so glad you admitted this, Danielle. I had no idea.
You know what? I actually think even though all of us might be slightly inwardly cringing that we're having this conversation and how it sounds, I actually think that it's really important to let women know that the person who's up there giving the talk or teaching or giving the reading or doing the event or leading who looks pretty good up there and has good hair and has good makeup and is wearing a cute outfit and cute shoes and all of that didn't wake up that way and stresses about it. Because I think it's a reality of the kind of work that we do, that it does in fact matter, like it or not.
Yeah.
Like it or not, it matters. And it's certainly not true for men, and it's not necessarily true for certain kinds of East Village literary poets or, you know, where it's kind of better to, I'm just going to go out on a limb and say this. I'm going to get totally killed for saying this. I'm going to get killed and I don't care. There's a certain kind of sort of, I'm going to show you that it actually really doesn't matter. I'm going to lead with, I don't care how I look.
Yeah.
That's a thing. It's a legitimate thing. It's not my thing. That's all I can say. It's like, I do care and I'm sort of expected to care. And that's just been the way it's been since I was a teenager. And therefore, yeah, those things matter. When the TSA lady at my local airport, when I was going to Florida, Linda, actually took away my anti-humidity spray. And I was like,
No.
I was talking to Glennon the other day, and she said, I am so sick of listening to myself. She said, Abby knows everything I say by heart now. And I said, you know what? I'm so sick of two things too. I'm sick of hearing my voice, but more than that, I'm sick of looking at myself. Do you guys ever get sick of just walking by the mirror? I mean, you have to look in the mirror, right? You have to wash your face. You have to put stuff on. I put on mascara every day. Some days I'm like, seriously, don't I love myself? I thought I loved myself, but I'm really sick of mirrors.
You know, there's this really fantastic essay by the writer Ruth Ozeki, who's published as a teeny tiny little book, and it's called The Face, Time Code. And she's also a Zen priest, Ruth. This publisher called Restless Books has this series of asking writers to write about their faces. Oh, and what Ruth did, because she's a Zen priest, is she spent 2 hours staring into the mirror at her own face as a meditation.
Yes.
And it's completely fantastic. Because you stare at your own face long enough, you start seeing your parents, your history, your grandparents, your ancestors, your younger self, you know, just morphs and morphs.
Yeah, there's a woman named Tara Well, who she came to one of my writing retreats, and she has a book on looking into your eyes. It's so beautiful. And she has these events, big events. And I think she had one at the Met recently in New York, where she'll have 200 people sitting in front of a mirror. And she did it at our retreat. She brought every one of us mirrors. And I saw exactly what you just said, Danny. I saw my father's eyes. And I loved my father's eyes. They were bright and light and they sparkled and they were the same color as mine. And as I was looking in the mirror, I was so moved. I saw myself as a soul. And I didn't see wrinkles or age spots. I didn't care. I didn't see anything but love. So thank you for that memory. You know what, Dan, I want to ask you about your schedule. Are you still showing up for banker's hours on this book? I mean, did you Monday through Friday, same?
No, my banker's hours have extended. I'm apparently a banker who works 24 hours a day. Writing this book was such a complete immersion for me. It felt more like writing poetry in a way than anything I've ever written, where I had to completely live inside of it. And so for that period of time when I was able to just step away from pretty much all of my other responsibilities except for my family, and really the freedom of just only working on it, it was utterly consuming. And I wonder whether that's a kind of evolution in a way. Like, what difference does it make that it's a weekend or that it's 10 o'clock at night or 4 o'clock in the morning? It was whenever it was available to me and beckoning me, I dove in.
Well, you guys are both making me feel so much better about the fact that I haven't released any of the books I'm working on right now. I have 3 that I'm working on, and I feel sometimes so ridiculous. I'm like, I remember my old life where I used to finish a book in 12 weeks. I was great with deadlines, and all the books that I wrote were pretty quick. My first one took longer, but the rest were quick. And I get a little judgy on myself and I think, God, what's wrong with me? And then I go, oh, wait, but all of that was before I had hundreds of clients. I think for anyone listening to us right now who doesn't have the ability to sequester or doesn't have any support, I remember Toni Morrison writing at the edges of the day when she had little kids. I don't get to write nearly as much as I used to or as much as I would love to, my God. But when I get the 15 minutes every morning or I get an hour at night, it's just as beautiful and just as heartwarming and sort of affair-like as it always was. And that's the thing that keeps me going. I think, okay, well, I'm not on track for time as I wanted to be, but that lover is always waiting for me. And the joy and the sort of juiciness of meeting that lover never, never goes away. Thank God. Mm.
I love that. I love the lover metaphor. Yeah, that's what it's like sometimes. And sometimes you argue.
True.
And sometimes, yeah, someone's late for the party. Yeah.
Danielle, your reviews for White Hot Truth are incredible as well. You have Dr. Mark Hyman saying that your voice is medicine for self-help fatigue and ambition overdrive, which is so true. You have Marianne Williamson calling you a bright light in the modern priesthood. We have Eve Ensler saying you're a force field of energy, wonder, humor, and love. And then there's Oprah, right? We can't forget Miss O, who says you're uniquely connecting the world together with a spiritual energy that matters. Yeah, no shit. So I know you have such big plans for this book, including the world's largest online book tour. So what are you most excited about right now?
So just to be clear, Oprah didn't say that about the book. If she did, I'd put it on the cover. I might have it tattooed somewhere. That was her talking about the Super Soul 100 group. So
yes,
everybody know that. This is what I'm most excited about. I just finished a new spoken word piece that I'm going to close my New York launch party with. So New York, it'll be May 17th, whenever that is, whenever this airs. That's my coming out party. Mm. And you know, I always close now with a poem, and I wasn't sure if something fresh was going to happen, and it did. And I'm just really looking forward to that one moment because it's my invitation to people to rise. Like I'm really, you know, the thesis of White Hot Truth is the best self-help is self-compassion. And I want people to feel relieved, like, oh God, I haven't been off track. Even though I looked off track, you can actually never get off track. Because you're always just like, you're human and you're doing it. And it is what it is. But more than that, and this is why the last chapter is about devotion. I'm saying, listen, I want you to love yourself in the deepest way possible. I want you to practice self-respect in the world. There's been a lot of response to what I'm writing about boundaries. That's cool.
Yeah.
This is where I'm really going to stand on a soapbox and I'm really going to wave my agenda flag and say, and now that you're loving yourself more deeply, would you please, I am asking you as someone who's going to take a position of leadership as a female using my voice, I'm asking you, would you please get off your ass and be of service to the world?
Amen.
Because we're in pain and we need what you have to offer at all times. So that is a long way of saying, I just want to read my poem. And then I'm good.
Yeah. I might actually be there. I may be going to New York. I'm going to see you at Agape, but I may be in New York at the same time. I can't wait to hear your poem live.
Oh, there. Well, let me know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I will.
Danielle, where's this happening?
It's going to be at Symphony Space.
Oh, very cool. That's a great space that has a kind of sacred feeling to it. So many beautiful, beautiful words have been spoken there for so many.
That's so great to hear. This is like another part. This is like in the same vibe as like, hey, you worry about being pretty on stage and you get your Spanx on. You know, it's also like, I don't know what it is in my brain. I think it's gratitude. I'm really grateful for everything that is the result of my creativity. So I still have this place in me where we just still hope people show up, right? And people are like, Danielle, are you kidding? Like, people are going to show up. And you're like, yeah, but you know, it's a bigger theater and maybe, and I, you know, it's always there. And I don't know if I want to lose that. Like,
yeah, that's just what I was thinking when you said that, is that I think a lot about the difference between confidence and courage. And the idea that I don't know, certainly for writers, I don't think confidence is a writer's friend. You think you want to feel it. You think, oh, it feels good to be confident. You know, confidence is, we want that. But what you're talking about, Danielle, is like having that feeling, that little, like the butterflies or just that feeling right before you go on, or that sense of, is anybody going to come to my party? Or now the theater is bigger. It's all getting bigger. It's like the stepping into the light. It's courage that's required to do that. Not so much confidence. And with too much confidence, we've all seen it happen to people. The message starts to become some kind of canned or diluted thing and not coming from a place of just 2 feet on the ground, a vulnerable human being out there speaking her truth.
Mm. Thanks. And I'm in this really intense and beautiful space and dynamic right now where, and this is a trajectory I've been on with, you know, Desire Map was about goals with soul and don't strive. And I'm like, how do I do this without striving? So it's like, you still want it and you want to fill up the theater and you're just like, oh, is anybody going to come? And at the same time, just like, I don't want to push. I don't want to push to fill up the theater. And it's a real, there's no other way to say it. It's a real spiritual practice right now. And I just, you know, how I communicate with my team mostly these days, this is so introverted, visionary style, is mostly through voice memo. And I've got 10 people in various time zones, like Philippines, Orange County, Vancouver, New York. So it actually is really practical. But the last message I said to them was like, you guys, we planted the seeds. Now we gently water. Let's just execute on the plan that we put into place. I don't have to go to an extra city. We don't have to knock on an extra door. I'm not going to get up at 4 a.m. to do that TV show because then that's going to wreck me for my evening thing. You know, now we just, well, we get to kind of dance and we can get to still be nervous. Are we going to be the right dance move? But let's just really want to have fun. I'm so done with not having fun. I'm getting where I want to go. So not to say things have been a chore, but I think most people, especially inner circle, would say I may have been a little pushy to get where I wanted to go before. But now, not so much.
I love how you, and this is perfect because I really wanted to ask you about this, Dee. I love how you talk about fewer goals now, and it's about more soul for you now. And I've always said that in my career of interviewing people for over 20 years, the first time I interviewed somebody who was over 70, and every time since then, I've always noticed that the more accomplished a person is over years, the more they tell me they're detached, that it's about fun, it's about ease. And the first or second time I heard it, I thought, well, yeah, because I was struggling, right? So I was like, well, yeah, it's easier to be detached when you've accomplished the things you've been striving for, when you have the money to pay your bills, when you've been seen. We've all met those people who on their way up the money and fame ladder are driven to the point of distraction. The people around them call them controlling or even rude. But I've seen those people, and I'm not talking about you, Danielle, because you're amazing, but I've seen those people transform. It's as if success changes them. It gives them validity that they've been searching for. It's as if it's saying to them, you were right. All those years you didn't have money, but you felt that you should, or all those years you had something to say, but nobody was listening. People now get it, and you were right. So as you look back on it, realistically, how much do you think your current level of peace and non-striving is due to having had such good success? Can you separate the two?
Can't separate the two. I think it's easy to say now. I can get on a plane and not have to figure out how I'm going to pay rent.
Yeah.
And I used to drive a really shitty car to get up to roll down the window and get back in and only one door locked. And I still get in my nice car and I'm still really grateful. So it's all easy to say. However, the stakes just get higher. And listen, here it is. I walked away from a publishing deal with one of the big five to go rogue and do this book on my own. It did not occur to me when I was all impassioned about my creative freedom and knowing that I wanted to start my own publishing company down the road, it didn't occur to me that somebody was going to have to pay to print these books and that somebody was now going to be me. So 6 months later, when I'm delivering the final manuscript to my copy editor, I get the first quote from the printer for $500,000.
Oh!
And I'm not risk averse. I'm like risk erotic. I love it. I say to my girls, I'll put my house up. Let's do it. Because if I take that 500 grand out of the business, I'm not going to be able to print day planners. I'm not going to be able to pay my team or my mortgage. That's okay.
No,
I'll get another mortgage. I'll get a line of credit. We'll find the money somewhere. So it's like there's still the risk and there's still the expansion. And I think how you stay fresh and you don't let the quote unquote success make you greedy. You have to continue to say no. Like no is my diet. I had to end in a relationship with someone in this whole process who was very close to a powerful person who could have changed my career. And I was really putting myself in a position of kissing a lot of ass to get a lot of doors open. And it was going to get gross and I couldn't do it. And I was also not being, my team was not being treated respectfully. And I remember the day I'm sitting on my back deck in the sun. And I said to my girls, I'm more concerned about your health than I am about getting famous.
Nice.
And that's all I want you to know. And there's nothing special for me about saying that. It's just like, Can we just get real? If you guys are sick, none of this matters. If I'm sick, there's no fun to be had. Yeah. So let's just let this go and say no. And gratitude. I'm healthy, got a healthy kid. I laugh lots and I'm honest when I write.
Dani, this brings up something I wanted to ask you. In the recent NPR review of Hourglass, it was said that you were ruthlessly clear about the trade-offs you and your husband unknowingly made in following your literary ambitions. They cited how you admitted to working 7 days a week with no savings or retirement and nothing to fall back on but each other. I'd like to know, actually, all three of us, I think this is a great conversation about what are the trade-offs. Well, first, Danielle, what are the trade-offs that you've made and what would you do differently now that you're in this different place?
I wouldn't do anything differently. So happy for all of my errors and all of it. I'm grateful for the lessons. The trade-offs, I don't really see anything as trade-offs or sacrifices. I mean, I have hard no's. Like, I do not travel when my kid is with me. So he has two homes, and when he's with his dad, the kid goes to school. Sometimes I walk him to school, I catch a cab to the airport, and he's with his dad for the 3 or 4 nights, and that's my trip. And many times, like, I've got the schedule perfect for New York and LA. I'm coming home from the airport. My little dude is walking in the door and he's like, hey, how was LA? We're home at the same time. And the cuddle fest begins. So there's so much I say no to I don't want to not be with my kid. Yeah. And more than ever, we can all relate as moms. It's like, oh, you know, when the time passes so quickly and when they're young. But now he's 13 and it's really starting to hit me. And I, you know, I'm really touched. Like, Linda, your boy is a man now. And Danny, I see your guy is like at college. And whenever you post about him coming home for the weekend from college, right, I cry. And you know, my dude is 13. And I'm just like, oh my gosh, in 4 years, he could be saying, going to Europe for the summer.
Yeah.
And I'll be like, oh, what about me? So more than ever, my trade-off is not traveling when my boy is home.
Yeah. Danny, yeah. What about you?
Yeah, no, I'm sitting here nodding. And actually, my boy is still in high school. He's a junior in high school. But what you're describing, his school had one of those spring parents' day on Saturday. And he knows the amount of traveling that I'm doing right now for my book. And he said something to me like, I'm so glad your schedule worked out so you could be here for this. And I was like, no, honey, my schedule had a blackout date on it so I could be here for this. And when he was your son's age, Danielle, I wasn't doing this kind of traveling. So it really, it's kind of the stuff that you can't take back and you don't ever want to regret. And I think for me, when it comes to my family life and the sense that my kid knows that he has always come first for me, no matter what else is going on in my life, anything that I could possibly be doing, I would drop in a heartbeat and have when his needs are present.
Well, here's what I want to say to support that. To everybody who's listening who's like, yeah, but I want to get where I'm going and the special gig and the invitation or that opportunity. Believe me or don't believe me, but here's what I have to say. These so-called opportunities you say no to now because of your standards or your family or your health, they always, always come back. Always. And they're usually sweeter. It's just the perfect day. And it's the right design. And it's a little bit more money. And they all come back.
Yeah. Bruce, I love that. Yeah. To go back to what you were asking, Linda, about Hourglass and the degree to which I was open and honest about the more scary aspects of my life and my husband's life and both of us being writers and the whole idea of not having a plan B, not having savings account or retirement plans and all of that. You know, you're honing in on the single most frightening aspect to me of writing that book, because there's a moment in Hourglass where there's a passage about what goes on Instagram. And then a page or two later, there's a passage that begins, what doesn't go on Instagram? I wanted to blow up the whole idea of the burnishment and the perfection. And I can't tell you the number of people in just the couple of weeks since Hourglass has been out, who I know who have read it, saying things to me like, I thought you were rich. Or that's not how you present, because I know how to present. In the world, I know how it looks. I have a beautiful house and I wear nice clothes and I drive a nice car and my son goes to private school. And what I really wanted to do was get underneath that at what sometimes it feels like at 3 o'clock in the morning. And you know what? That has been probably the most universal aspect of the book in terms of its resonance for people, because in a way, it goes back to what we were talking about earlier about wanting to look a certain way when we get up there. In a way, what it's doing is it's saying to readers, oh, you're human, just like me. You're up at 3 o'clock in the morning having these thoughts and feelings and anxieties and fears. It makes it more okay that I'm having those too. It reflects back at me the idea that this is part of the human condition, not something that I'm experiencing in isolation in some way. And as a writer, I mean, I always say this to my students, but it's harder, of course, to remember it for oneself. Like, the thing that feels the most frightening, the most risk-taking, the most like, oh my God, I don't know if I can write that, it's revealing too much, that's precisely the tender place where someone reading, someone listening is going to just breathe a sigh of relief and just think, me too.
Oh God, yes. You know, speaking of that 3 o'clock in the morning, what you just said, when I think back on the trade-offs that I made, I, like the two of you, I'm a mama bear, right? My kid comes first. And all three of us, interestingly, have single boys. We had only children. So the trade-off for me was sleep, because during the day I was going to be Mr. Mom. During the day, I was going to be mom. I was going to be hands-on. I actually was married to a Mr. Mom, too. So he was home most of the time as well as an actor. So the two of us were hands-on all day long with our child. And the trade-off for me was sleep. I didn't get a lot of it, that's for sure. But the one time, and I learned this early and I'm grateful, the one time I went for an outward goal. So I was a journalist and Donald Trump wanted to be interviewed by me and I got the call. His executive assistant at the time called me and said, this never happens. This is really unusual, but he'd like you to come to New York for an interview. Well, I had no money. We had no money for me to hop on a plane to go interview him. And I was doing my follow-up book to Lives Charmed, which I got so sick of, I never published. Actually, some of the disaster stories behind that book are in my memoir now, but I couldn't go. I said, well, is he going to fly me out? She said, no. And I said, well, I'll be there in a couple of months. So I didn't check with my son's school. For whatever reason, I was spaced out and I made the flight to go to New York when I could afford it. And I didn't realize while I'm in New York, I am missing the mother-son bowling event that the PTA had put on. And of course, I didn't have time to be a member of the PTA, right? Because I was so exhausted all the time from trying to write all night. I'd show up at their bake sales. I'd be totally bleary-eyed with red eyes and twigs in my hair. And they'd be like, oh, hi, Linda, nice to see you. Can you run the chocolate ice cream section? And I was so tired, I could barely help out. But I was always home. When my son was home from school, I was there for him. So I felt good about that until I get bawled out from the PTA. For not only did I miss the mother-son bowling event, but I didn't cover, which meant that my son didn't get to go. My sister could have gone. She could have been anti-bowling partner, but I didn't even realize I missed it. So here's my kid, the only kid left out of the mother-son bowling event. And that messed me up. That really was the wake-up call I needed. He was 8 years old, but I didn't make that mistake again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you know, it kind of goes back to what Danielle was saying about lessons learned and the idea. You know, this past weekend, I was on a panel with Elizabeth Lesser. And whose wonderful book, Marrow, was recently published. And we were on a panel on memoir. And someone in the audience during the Q&A asked Elizabeth to define the word redemption, because the word redemption was being thrown around a bit, as it tends to with memoirs. You know, it's like, is there always redemption in a memoir? And Elizabeth, among other things that she said, she had a wish that had been recorded because she had such a beautiful definition. But one of the things that she said was waste nothing, waste nothing. And I was thinking about that. And I was thinking, you know, you have an experience like that that's painful. And I think everyone who's a mother at a certain point or another has a moment of feeling like, I'm failing my kid here, you know, either because of something like you're describing with scheduling or because of saying the wrong thing, or like having a short fuse about something or whatever it is. No one gets through parenthood without that feeling. but I think probably something that may separate people who continue to evolve as parents from people who maybe don't as much is this being wasted? Is this moment being wasted, or is it actually being absorbed as something like, oh, that won't happen again, you know?
And we can all take consolation in the fact that they're going to be in therapy for some reason, so it's inevitable.
No shit. Okay, Danielle, I have just a couple intermission quickies for you. Of course, you know I have to ask this one. Sleep or sex?
Sex. Wait, let me think about that. Yep, sex.
All right, green drink or OJ?
Green.
LA or Vancouver?
Vancouver.
High heels or bare feet?
High heels.
Favorite live stage so far?
Like favorite concert?
No. Yes, that's a good one.
Favorite. Oh, let's go with concert. Two. They're tied. Sinead O'Connor in the 90s when she was at the height and she just came out in like a white tank top and a kilt and acoustic and just threw her guitar down on stage after last song and was like, fuck you all. And I was like, oh my God, I love you. And Glenn Hansard, who, if you can get anywhere to see him in concert, he is the ultimate folk performer. Yeah. Beautiful.
Best beauty secret?
Well, other than sleep or sex, best beauty secret. Oh, sandalwood oil. So I make my own toner, my own mister. Water with just a little pinch of sea salt with like 7 drops of sandalwood, rose, and frankincense. That's it. Basically holy water for your face.
Okay, last one. I've never asked you this, but I've always wondered. Do you ever still sneak cigarettes?
Oh, well, listen, they've evolved. The sneaking has evolved. So everybody's Linda asking because she knows that I always used to have a pack of Marlboro Lights wrapped in tinfoil in a Ziploc bag in the back of my freezer. And now a friend has turned me on to, are you ready? This is such shit New Age girls say. Essential oil vapes.
No.
Yes. So you can get these little tiny, they're like a little baby, you know, those Popeye candy cigarettes you used to get in school. Yeah. They're kind of like that, but you're just kind of inhaling like a bit of lavender oil. And I have one of those. And just every once in a while before bed, as I'm looking over the city, thinking about life, I'm just like, yeah, I need a hit of that. So that's it. I'm so not fun anymore.
I love it. All right, I have a couple more questions. As I'm finishing up several books right now, I've been thinking a lot about the point of each book. You know, what I want people to walk away with from each piece. What are the main themes? What's my point? So with my memoir, I want people to remember to believe in their own magic. And Danielle, I've heard you say that you want people to know that they're their own guru and that you want people to feel a sense of relief when they finish White Hot Truth. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah.
And Danny, what do you want people to walk away with after reading Hourglass?
You know, I think that the best distinction right there is that I never thought about that as I was working on it. For the kind of book that Hourglass is, if I had thought about it, it would have created a kind of self-consciousness that would have made it impossible to write. But, you know, I really like the word relief. I think that there's something in reading memoir, probably it also true in reading any kind of literature, where there's just this feeling of connection, a feeling of being able to just sort of fully enter into the consciousness of another human being and feel like less apart than connected. But that's something I think about it all the time, but I don't think about it while I'm actually writing. I think about it a lot too in the stage that I'm in now and that Danielle is entering into now, you know, when you're bringing a book out into the world and you're actually seeing with your own eyes what its impact is, because you can never really know while you're doing it until it starts to make its way.
You know, I want to talk about time for a second. My 27-year-old said something really foreign to me the other day. He said, you know, Mom, I've always felt that there's enough time. And I was like, what? You know, that's easy for you to say. That's because I mostly paid your bills. And he laughed. But his comment kind of played with me for a little bit. And I liken it to something that Anne Lamott said in our interview with Glennon. She said that she's a very afraid person with a huge amount of faith. And I think I feel that way about time, that there's never enough of it and it's always slipping away. But conversely, everything happens in perfect timing. And, you know, I always accomplish what's needed for my highest good. So I'd like to hear how each of you feel about your dichotomous relationship with time. Danny?
Yeah, no, it's so much of everything that I've been obsessed and thinking about for years, because there's this paradox, right? A friend of mine who recently started meditating said to me something that I thought was so exactly right about meditating, which was, it's amazing how you can spend 20 minutes in the morning meditating and you end up with more time during the day, as opposed to having those 20 minutes taken away from you, time expands. And I think there's just nothing like, for me, that sense of the daily reminder of entering and being centered in the present moment, losing it, returning to it, losing it again, returning to it again, that daily reminder of what it is to not just simply kind of slip into the speed of life and the way that time does seem to. I mean, there's a moment in Hourglass where I recall something that the writer Grace Paley once said, which she said, from ages 50 to 80, it's not minutes, it's seconds.
Oh, and that hurts when I read that. That just hurts.
And I remember thinking, like, well, I don't know if that's true or not, but I'm guessing it is. So one of the things I really wonder about, Danielle, is that, because I know you have a meditation practice and you also travel a lot, I really struggle with, when I'm home and I have my special spot where I meditate and I have my essential oils and I have my all my little rituals that I set up and I have my insight timer and I have everything I need and I have my ritual that allows me to enter into meditation, I have no resistance, or not very much, to sitting down every morning and doing my practice. When I'm traveling, it's a little bit like what you were describing about not being able to write in hotel rooms. I feel like it's impossible. I find it impossible. And it's when I need it most, to sit in my hotel room before my coffee in a room. I was talking about this with a friend of mine who's an acupuncturist, and he said, it's because there are so many lives that have been lived in that room. Like, you're picking up on all of the energy of everyone who's ever been in that room the day before you and the day before that and the day before that. And I would imagine that the people listening who practice meditation have similar kinds of struggles in terms of, you sit, you have a practice, and then you lose it, and then you find it again. Or life isn't always, we don't get to be home every morning in our perfect little universes. And how to find the way into the practices that allow us to hold time in a different way, to understand its preciousness and to center ourselves in the present moment, which really is all there is.
For me, I'm able to keep my practice up because I change my practice up. So, you know, I'll do a particular meditation for 108 days and I'm so excited to figure out what the next one's going to be. Tomorrow, actually, I will start the next 40 days of something that's just, I knew what was coming up. I'm going to be on the road. So it's going to be X minutes long. I'm going to be working with this color and this deity, you know. So that's how I stay fresh. This probably isn't healthy, but I have this kind of like jinxy vibe around meditation. Like, if I don't meditate this morning, this interview is not going to go well. So I threaten myself into meditating. It's so, this is probably so backwards. But like, I gotta do it. Yeah. And also so much permission to not do it or to skip it. Or, you know what, today I'm going to have to just, like, it's 3 minutes of just handing it over to God, sitting on this park bench. And I'm going to just go out there and give her my best. Yeah. And, you know, as for like the greater relationship with time, Linda, I was glad you asked Danny first, because I was like, I haven't thought about this enough. I don't think about time that much. I mean, I have pressures and there's the ways that things creep in, and I have a terrible time getting to bed early enough. Right. Like, I have a thing to sleep and I'm really actively analyzing it. It's a real addictive behavior for me, staying up late. But I just really get off on like the time bending space of things. That's why meditation is important to me. I so relate to that. 20 minutes in the morning gets you like an extra X out during the day. And I can have 10 minutes to to make a 20-minute drive across the city. And just say, well, I'm just going to bend time and get there on time. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you hit all the green lights. And I feel like I'm reverse aging, actually, since I got divorced. So I'm getting younger every year. And I've been asked to do a couple interviews with people like, hey, will you talk about what it means to be in your 40s and be this? I'm like, why would I want to do that?
Yep.
I don't even identify with it. Like, I don't get it. I don't get it. All that to say, I think I'm in total fucking denial about time. And so ask me.
You know what? You said that,
like,
Danielle.
5 or 7 years. And I'm just like, oh my God, it's all gone.
Danielle, yeah. That's hilarious. You said basically that same thing when we interviewed Arianna Huffington about sleep. Remember, you were like, I think I'm in denial about sleep.
Yeah, I am.
Seems to be working for you. You look younger than when I met you, so I'm not too worried about you.
Thanks. It's my magic tonic and the vape cigarettes. Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. So most of our guests, including Danny here, have been on Oprah. And the stories are really inspiring for anyone hoping to be blessed with positive media when they go out into the world with their books, Oprah or otherwise. Since you've been on this show, you've been named an Oprah Top 100 leader. Do you want to share any details with us? I think a lot of us were really excited. We had waited for that to happen. We figured it was going to happen. And then it happened. Do you have any Oprah effect details you want to share with us?
I just have like Oprah reality. I got the email, would you please be one of the Super Soul 100? And I turned to my kid, you know, he just got home from school. And I'm like, oh, Pook, I call him Pookie. I'm like, Pook, Oprah's team just emailed me and like Super Soul 100. And he was like, awesome. The downstairs toilet is clogged. Can you come to the kitchen? And I'm just like, and we're back to reality. So that's like, don't feel special. You still have to do stuff like this. So that's really my Oprah story. It feels like an honor. You get to meet lots of other really lovely people who want to do something meaningful in the world. And having brunch with Oprah on a Sunday does not suck. And Stedman just walks in his Adidas tracksuit and you're just like, dude, you are so here for the free food. And where I was struck most about with Ms. Winfrey was she's really warm. She's really has this, you know, she's bounded. There's not an air as in like an affectation, but she's a queen. That's for real. She is ruling her empire. And at the same time, so sincere. Just really, when she's warm, you actually feel the warmth. Yeah. So it's only good. Only good.
Yeah. I would completely agree with Danielle in terms of that sense of Oprah's warmth and her personal power. There's no sense in sitting with her that she doesn't completely understand the incredibly ranging impact that she has. And yet she somehow manages to wear that really lightly and to be able to, in a way, train her attention so completely on the person that she's with. I mean, her superpower may be her greatest superpower of her many, may be her really genuine, profound curiosity about other people. So Danielle, since the topic of this show is beautiful writing and you're known for your beautiful prose, what's your best tip for writing beautifully?
Be honest. Yeah, be honest. I'm always in a space of there's something I want to get out. I need to express myself, this idea. And then I want that to be useful and be of service. But part of that, part of the packaging of that is I do not want to waste your time. If I think I have wasted your time with an overly flowery sentence or a paragraph that didn't need to be in there, I'm like mortified. I worship at the altar of word economy. Okay, so I've been honest and I've been as articulate and artful as I can be. How can I save you some time? Cut, cut, cut. And I get it down to 3 sentences.
And does it take you a long time? I don't think it does. You're a quick writer from what I know, Danielle.
Yeah, I'm a quick writer because I'm an entrepreneur. So I got other things to do. I got this blog post. I've also got a day planner line and there's gigs. And I just spent yesterday writing the White Hot Truth Journal and the White Hot Truth Deck. And I'm working on a White Hot Truth course. So that blog post, That's good. That's the best I got right now. Best send.
Well, I think there's also something to be said for knowing when something is finished. Any piece of writing could benefit from being put in a drawer and taken out a year later and put in a drawer again and taken out a year later and continuing to do that. And then the world never has it, right? At a certain point, you say, this is what I've got. This is the best that I can do. Here you go.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let it go.
I'm going to chew on that one. All right. So in closing, I just have one more question. Danny, you have never shied from writing about painful things, your parents' car crash, your affair with the married man, your mother's Alzheimer's, your marriage. You say, I've become convinced that our lives are shaped less by the mistakes we make than when we make them. So this is an hourglass. I was stopped in my tracks when I read that. You said, there is less elasticity now, less time to bounce back. And so I need the urgent whisper and move with greater and greater deliberation. I hold my life with M, that's your husband, carefully in my hands like the faience pottery we brought back from our honeymoon long ago. We are beautiful. We are not new. We must be handled with care. That is so stunning. We are not new. Is it more natural for you to write those really deep, sort of authentic, truthful pieces than something maybe more joyous? How do you balance that?
I don't think it's harder or easier. I think so much of what my inquiry was in writing Hourglass and so much of what I was wanting to drill down into was from a place of being in a happy and content relationship of nearly 20 years. And at the same time, within that relationship, time goes by. People grow at different rates. There is invariably going to be complexity and disappointment and challenges. And what I started to really recognize in the writing of it was that that is part of the beauty. The pottery that you mentioned that I write about in the book is beautiful, perfect faience pottery from a village in Provence in France that we brought back from our honeymoon. But actually, what would be an infinitely better sort of metaphor as pottery would be wabi-sabi, you know, would be the kind of pottery that is beautiful because of its imperfection, that is, you know, showing its cracks and ways in which it is less than what we would consider to be perfect or ideal. And that, to me, was sort of at the heart of the book. So I can't really separate out that sense of not being new and needing to be more careful. And really that idea, Linda, that sentence that you read about our lives are shaped less by the mistakes we make than when we make them, that was a moment that I wrote a sentence and I looked at it and I thought, oh my God, I think that's really true.
Yeah.
I think I've actually, it's not like I thought it and then I wrote it. I wrote it and then, as often happens, I recognized the truth in it. Mm. And that comes from my own life. I mean, I got married and divorced when I was 19 years old. I shrugged it off. No kids, no joint financial lives, not much of anything really to have to kind of contend with. Someone who is in midlife or is older and has to deal with either recalibrating, kind of restarting a journey, whether it's a job or it's a marriage or it's a friendship, it's a relationship. There's a lot more road behind than ahead. And I don't think that that's depressing. I think it's true.
Yeah.
And I don't ever really find anything that's really true to be depressing.
I so agree. I love how, Danielle, when you write in chapter 15 about when the negative serves the positive, you cannot have the light without the dark. And I think you both inspire me to be more honest, to be more real. And Danielle, that case, it was more humorous. It was that whole story about, well, do you remember it? You can tell it if, unless you want me to.
What's
the angel workshop where you said, don't judge me.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
There was a woman who stood up and was saying something that the workshop leader just didn't think was positive enough. It was like this kind of conspiracy theory. So my first point is, if you can't talk about a wacky conspiracy theory at an angel workshop, then where is it safe to talk about your conspiracy theories? And the other is like, we can't deny negativity and that there's more than negativity. Like, there is brutality happening in our own neighborhoods. and massive destruction of humanity and deforestation. Oh, like, this is really real. We have to look it in the eye in order to be something that often gets labeled as negative, in order to be outraged sometimes,
yes,
in order to reach deep within to find the creativity to then go do something about it and like create solutions. But solutions don't come from harmony.
Oh my gosh.
Tanya,
you just reminded me before we close, this deforestation issue, you know, is always top of mind for me. And
as I saw you're marching on Earth Day.
Oh, well, always. But, you know, I've been marching for forests since I was 18. And it's a big conflict, don't get me wrong. Being the book mama whose work helps fell thousands of trees, it's a total mind fuck and something I've been trying to work with and rectify all of my career. But I want to talk about your recycled paper. So, you know, I've done a book before. I walked, if Simon & Schuster wouldn't do a book on recycled paper with soy ink, and they did it, thank God. But your book, it's eco-friendly, right?
Part of them are. So this is a tough business decision.
Yes.
I love this conversation because this is the teeth of entrepreneurship. You get the quote in, and the quote for 100% recycled paper stock is 3 times as much as using 20 to 30% content of recycled paper.
Holy hell.
This is messed up. There will be a sea change as more of us make the investment, not even an investment, you're going to give up some money. It's not just like organic food, the supply and demand. So we decided to print a certain chunk of them on the eco-friendly paper and just do what we could afford to do and make a commitment that in the future, we're going to do more. And yeah, I want to do them all. But like I told you, like a little surprised by a $500,000 printing bill.
Well, good for you, though. You had the intent. You did the research. And you're doing what you can. That's all anybody can ask. I always try to think about when I think back on my career and the books that I did not do in an eco-friendly way or the books that I help create now for others that are not eco-friendly, I think, okay. And I don't know the bigger picture. I can sit here on my high horse and be judgmental, or I can say, yes, but how much healing is happening because of these words? It's not really my place to make a decision about what's right or wrong. But I love the conversation, as you just said. I love talking about this and educating people. And you're right. As more and more people start leaning towards recycled paper, it will get cheaper. There will be better outlets and channels for doing it. But I think it's an important conversation to at least get started.
And I can add that the gold foil, which is really all I've ever wanted in life, is gold foil on one of my book covers, is LEED certified, and that costs extra money. And in the same vein of social responsibility and intention, proceeds from the book are going to Eve Ensler's V-Day to end violence against women and girls.
Bravo.
And to Charity Water.
Bravo. Yeah. I love you women so much. Danny, I will see you this Saturday at Jillian's D. I will see you at Agape and hopefully in New York. And just thank you. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Love, respect. Thank you.
Danielle, I just want to wish you the best of everything with your launch. And I'll be following it with excitement and just thrilled for everything that you're bringing into the world.
Ditto.
Thank you. Mutual.
All right. Until next time.
Okay, love. Thanks. Love. Bye.
Thanks so much for listening. And big, big thanks to my guest host, Danny Shapiro, who was awesome to come on with me to interview Terry McMillan last year and now this. And thanks to Dee, always Dee. If you're writing and hope to get a book deal at some point, Danielle and I created a digital program called Your Big Beautiful Book Plan years ago. The subtitle is How to Create a Book Proposal That Will Make You a Visionary Writer, a Stronger Business Person, and Land You a Publishing Deal. I am still so proud of this baby, and it is still helping a lot of people get signed to publishers. So you can find that over on yourbigbeautifulbookplan.com. My best piece of advice probably for improving your writing is to read the best of the best, and White Hot Truth and Hourglass will be soothing balm to your soul. Well, that's it. If you enjoyed today's show and want to share the love, your stars over on iTunes are always appreciated. Until next time, write on.